is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. Time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
This is Drew Tignanelli here with Money, Riches, and Wealth. CJ, Christopher, John.
Andrew, I'm here. We're back together here in the standoff Irish-Italian togetherness, actually. So, and it's good to be here.
That's true.
We have an open show tonight.
We do have an open show, and we're going to make our listeners our guests tonight. They get to call in and ask any question they want to, and they get to determine the course of the conversation tonight. So whatever they want to talk about, we'll be here to answer, and it doesn't matter if it's on a topic of, you know, investments or income taxes or elder care or IRAs or 401ks or company benefits or elder care planning, estate planning, and, you know, you name the topic. If it's dealing with your personal finances, we want to address it for you and do our best to give you some guidance as to where to go. And, you know, the objective of the show is to be educational, because we feel that it's important to demonstrate what we believe a true professional financial advisor should do. They should not just be, you know, glad-handing and telling you that they're a financial advisor and sell you some products and move on their way. They should be able to help you with income taxes and estate planning and elder care and insurances, and not sell the product, not take the commission, just give good, solid, advice without an economic bias. And that's something that I was talking to Sean about this morning, Chris. Economic bias, and economic bias drives is probably the most important question you can ask anybody in anything, in whatever industry it is, whether it's an auto dealer or an auto mechanic, if it's a restaurant or a waiter or waitress at the restaurant, if it's a store owner, you know, what's your economic bias? What are you doing? Why does that grocery store put that really special thing out for, you know, like a buck that you know costs $1.75, but they're selling it for a buck when you know it's really $1.75? Why do they do that? It's economic bias. They're trying to get you in the door and then force you to be compelled to buy more things from them that they have up at full price, you know. And there's nothing wrong with this. It's just as you understand it. And that's the thing about our industry that is so bad, in my opinion, is that there's an incredible economic bias of the people selling products to their clients, telling them that they're a financial advisor and that you can trust them. But yet, if they really stepped back and said, I'm not going to get anything from this decision or this advice I'm giving my client, you wouldn't make the decisions you're making. And I say that out of the pot calling the kettle black, because we used to do that. You and I, back before 1995, we were commission and fee-based. And it wasn't that we were dishonest people. It's just that we had a business model that said we had to sell the products that we were going to make commissions on.
And we tried to do it to the best of our ability under that umbrella. But after a while, we said we could not reject the fact that we had to admit that bias had to eke its way in there.
It did. And nowadays, when a client comes in and they need a big insurance policy, it doesn't matter to us. We're going to help that client figure out where is the best economic decision for them, whether it's with Northwestern Mutual or Banner Life or Lincoln National. It doesn't matter to us. Or if it's a group life insurance policy under the company, totally irrelevant to us. We want to look and explain to the client the differences and the pluses and minuses of each and every decision, and not have a bias in a horse in the race or a bias in that decision. Economic bias, in my opinion, it's what I call what's in it for them. What's in it for them is the most important question you can ask in anything you're doing when you're spending money. What's in it for them? What's in it for a lawyer? What does a lawyer look for? It's time. Lawyer is all about time. There's two parts to the equation. They don't just want to run the time up, but they also want to control the time from not getting run up. Because they know that if I do a will for you and I spend 18 hours with you, and I'm going to try to charge you $5,500 and your net worth is only $800,000, you're just not going to go for it. So if I tell you I'm going to do this will for you for $1,200 or $1,000, let's say, and you buy into it and you say, hey, that's a good price, I'll do that. Now the lawyer wants to control their time. They only want 3 or 4 hours maximum into that deal because they know that's about the most they can put into it at their hourly rate, which means that they might rush in and rush out, make you rush into a decision and try to make you feel like you're making a great decision. And this is what you have to understand. And there's always two sides to this, what's in it for them. That's the negative side. The positive side is what's in it for them to make it a good experience for that professional you're working with, too. You want it to be a good experience so that that lawyer or accountant or doctor or whatever, that auto mechanic, is thinking, you know, I really will like working for these people because they appreciate me as much as I'm trying to appreciate them. And you know, when you look at life from that what's in it for them perspective, it makes all the difference.
Because there are people we found in almost every industry that people have separated themselves to do that.
Absolutely.
The mechanic that I know, nobody there is on commission. You know, he pays them salary. They're taking their time on the car. He knows that you don't want to spend everything at one time. He lets you spread things out. You do a little bit now, you do a little bit later, you know, what you need to do.
Yeah. What's in it for them, Chris? It's the greatest question anyway. We're on an open show tonight. We're letting our listeners be the guests tonight. And so call in. There's nobody online. If you want to call in, direct the conversation, 410-922-6680. Now's the time to call in, early part of the show. We're going on a pause in a second or two. So now's the time to call in, 410-922-6680. If you want to call in and direct the conversation in the next part of the show, right now I got to take a pause with traffic. I'll be right back. Money, Riches, and Wealth. It's too easy to answer. That's all I say. I got to move on there, Chris. If you've got a problem with that, I'm
help.
Moving on. You can help.
The next phrase was, I can help. Right.
I hear you. I'm going to our callers. We're on an open show tonight, 410-922-6680. If you want to call in and ask a question, 410-922-6680. I got a couple people online, and we're going to go to them. People calling early, they're the ones that get the most help. We're going to Paul in Pikesville. Paul, how can we help you?
Hi, gentlemen. Thank you for taking the call. I just recently was terminated from my job, so I have a 401k with Hancock, John Hancock. I want to put some of those funds into an IRA and then move that IRA into a HSA.
Okay. You can only do that once in your lifetime. Do you have an do you have a high deductible health plan?
Yes, we do. We just got that on my wife's plan.
Okay, now wait a minute. You said something very interesting there. Only your wife can move from an IRA to the HSA if it's her plan and her HSA.
Can we not use their HSA but get a separate HSA, like through a bank?
Say that you can have one for $1,000. And I'm thinking, Chris, if the wife has the HSA,
right.
She has the high deductible health plan. So can she allocate the amount that she can put in, the $6,900 this year, to him? How old are you, Paul, and how old is your wife?
She just turned 50, and I am 58.
Okay, so Paul's eligible for the $1,000 catch-up.
Right.
But can she allocate half of the family HSA contribution to him in a plan?
Only if he has his own plan.
Yeah, I don't know. I think
only if he has his own plan.
Well, I know he can put $1,000 in,
yes.
And then
yes.
She can put in $6,900. That
right.
I know for a fact.
Right.
But does she have an IRA, Paul?
No, she does not. But it's a family plan. We're covered with a family plan through her employee.
Sure.
She has the option for an HSA, but can we go out to a private HSA and get a family plan, which would be the $6,900?
Yeah, no, you can. I mean, you could do $6,900. There's no doubt, and you could put another $1,000 into the plan.
But they're separate accounts. You can't have a joint account in that.
You can't have a joint account, so it's either got to be in your name or your wife's name. What I don't actually have ever done is I've never allocated the $6,900 that she has the right to do to the spouse who doesn't have the high deductible health plan. And but I think you can actually. I'm just, you know how you do the, you know when you, when we do the catch up contribution, it says how are you allocating this HSA contribution between the husband and the wife, and you know you say 1,000 over here and you know 6,900, you know, et cetera.
Sure.
And it, and you know, could you put the 6,900 over here and still work even though he's not the one with the high deductible health plan?
I'll let you go in that direction. I've always felt that they had to have
the high deductible plan themselves in order to do the 6,900. But you know, the other issue is, Paul, if you go off to a separate bank or something to do the plan, you're probably going to be missing some of the best benefits of the HSA. And that is if your wife funds that full HSA through payroll deductions, you not only save income tax, but you save the Social Security and Medicare tax on that too.
Right.
Okay.
And so, you know, I'm not, you know, I wish there were another way we could get the money into an IRA for your wife to do that, a one-time transfer, but you can always do $1,000 per year catch-up contribution to the HSA. You can do $1,000 one time out of the IRA. So you'd really want to use that for the biggest bang for your buck where you do it out of your plan. You know,
would you recommend, though, since I am terminated, to move the funds and don't even sit it in the 401k because of the expense ratios?
Well, the expense ratio in the 401k case could be very high, and that's not unlikely, okay? So moving it to the IRA can be a benefit. The first thing you have to answer for me is you're not being sued. Is that true?
Correct.
Okay, so that's the first thing. And the second thing is the 401k plan that the employer doesn't have any unique investments that you really want to participate in. Is that true?
No, they don't. It's a target plan that I
Yeah.
Think.
Okay, so then I would probably move to the IRA, and, you know, there's no doubt I would probably move to the IRA and do it as a direct rollover. That would open up a lot of opportunities like what you're talking about, and you may be able to do what you're thinking about, where you allocate a portion of the family contribution to you instead of your wife, and therefore you can do this one-time rollover in there, but I'm not positive we can do that. I've just never done it. So I wish I could help you better on that right now.
Okay. Well, I'll do more research also.
All right, buddy. You take care. We ought to look into that. That would be an interesting one, Chris. Gary in Columbia, how can we help you?
Hi. Good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
What can I do?
My question has to deal with capital gains on the sale of a principal residence.
Okay.
Now, as I understand, a husband and wife, if you live in the house two of the last 5 years and you sell your house, you are not obligated to pay capital gains on up to $500,000.
Correct.
Now, what happens if the spouse, one spouse passes away?
You have 2 years from the date of that spouse passing away to get the $500,000 capital gain exclusion. If I'm not mistaken, it's 2 years from the day they die. But remember this, Gary, if one of the spouses dies, you get a step up in basis on half of the value of the house. So let me explain that. So let's say I have $100,000 cost basis in a house, and the house is now worth $500,000. So I have $400,000 a gain. And lo and behold, my spouse dies unexpectedly. And next thing you know, it's 3 or 4 years later, and now I want to sell the house, and I'm thinking, gosh, I got a $400,000 gain, and now I only get a $250,000 write-off. So I'm concerned, but here's what you're missing in the equation. When the spouse died and the house was worth $500,000, you get a step up in basis, and here's how that works. Half of the house would be immediately the cost basis would be moved up to the value at the time of death. That's $250,000. Half of the house, $250,000. The other half of the house will retain the original cost basis, which would be $50,000. My new cost basis will be $300,000. I now only have a $200,000 gain, and I've got a $250,000 capital gain exclusion.
Okay, so in essence, you're capturing the spouse's portion of the $250,000 capital gains, but it's really a step up in value. As a
yeah, but you know, Gary, if this was $1.5 million house that I paid $100,000 for, I would have gotten a step up on $750,000 on half of the value of the house, and then the other $50,000, my new cost basis would be $800,000. So in that case,
it's actually better.
Even better, but you know, it's an unfortunate consequence to get to that better scenario. But if you had that situation happen, what you really want to do is go and value the house in the year of passing and make sure you understand your step up in basis before you worry about the capital gain exclusion.
Right. In my case, what I did is I got an appraisal.
Absolutely. That's great. That's the best way to go, is to get an appraisal, but you don't even necessarily have to go that full legal route unless you're worth a lot of money. If you're worth $5-10 million, I'd say get an appraisal. If you're worth $1 million, $1.5 million or less, I'd say just get some good real estate agents, tell you what the value of the house is.
Okay.
All right.
But it's not ill-advised to get an appraisal.
No. We're only talking about $300 or $400.
Right.
But $300 or $400 that's well spent if the IRS were ever questioned you. Chances are they ever going to question you is very slim, though.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you. It's a little bit different than I thought, but actually, in a sense, it's a little bit better. So I appreciate it.
All right, man. You take care.
Okay, you too.
We're on an open show. So, Bob, I hope you hold on for me, and I have to take a pause, but I'm going to be back. Anybody else who wants to get online, I have three lines open, so it would be easy to call in right now, 410-922-6680, if you want to call in and be online. And right now, I got to take a pause with traffic. Take it away, traffic. And we're back, Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're on an open show, 410-922-6680. And during the break, Chris and I did some homework, and we're still split on the decision, but I think that the rule says that even if you have the same HDHP, two spouses can put in the max limit in either account. And
you can go up to $6,900,
but the combined. The husband who called us, and I can't remember what his name was, he could do an extra $1,000. So
right.
For them, total, they could do $7,900.
Correct.
They better make sure they have a good tax accountant that does that, because that form can get real tricky, especially if you split it between two. I got to go
if you're doing it after payroll deductions, right, outside of payroll deductions.
True.
Right.
Bob in Hamilton, how can we help you?
Hi, Drew. My fiance's parents just turned 80, both of them, and he just died.
Okay.
And she's got to take his IRA, which I think is about $18,000, and somehow get it in her name or whatever would be the best to do.
Was she the beneficiary under the IRA account form? That's the most important question. We see what I mean there, is that if she's inheriting it, but she wasn't a beneficiary with the finance, what financial institution was it with, Bob?
Well, it's through BB&T. I can't remember.
Okay. So if it was BB&T, all right, and wherever they did it, there's a beneficiary form, and the beneficiary form is either left blank, and so she's inheriting it as the heir under the will. That's a bad scenario. Or she's the beneficiary under a beneficiary form with the IRA custodian. That's the good one. And what happens in that scenario is she would go in as the beneficiary, and she'd say, I'm the beneficiary. My father passed away. Here's the death certificate. Change this account to an inherited IRA. What that means, Bob, is that they would keep the account in his name, but he would be considered deceased now, and she would be considered the beneficiary. And there are special rules. When did he die? In 18?
Just about 2 weeks ago.
Okay. So he died in 18. Sometime between now and the end of 2019, she must make what's called a required minimum distribution. I'm not going to get into all the rules as to how you determine that, but it's not a lot of money for her. It would probably be about 3%. And so 3% of 18,000 is about $540. She would have to withdraw from that account before the end of 2019. And every year there's a recalculation. She has to take it out. And sometime around age 85, she has to take out the last dollars of that account. But here's the good news, Bob. She can always take any amount from the account she wants to as long as she takes the minimum. That's all that counts. And she would more than likely have to pay taxes on that because I'm assuming it's a traditional IRA your father, your fiancé's father had.
Oh, okay, so she could draw any time as much as she needed, as long as it was above the minimum RMD?
That's correct. Now, again, the first RMD on that account is due December 31st of 2019, except if your future father-in-law had not taken his required minimum distribution for 2018. I'm going to assume he had already taken out what he had to take out by law. Is that right?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, you're going to have to find that out, because if he didn't, then your fiancé is going to have to take that out before the end of 2018. That's his required minimum distribution. It wasn't taken out in the first 6 months. And then okay. Once she gets that out of the way, her first one is not due until December of 2019. And as long as she takes the minimum each year, she can take out as much as she wants to.
And then she pays taxes on it.
And then she pays taxes on it. And there's, you know, not much planning strategy you got to do. It's basically the law. You got to just pay taxes on it every year.
Oh, great. That sounds wonderful.
And now, how old is your fiancé?
She's 60.
60, okay. Is she 10 years from now, if she still has that IRA... You should, and you two have charitable interests, you should start looking into qualified charitable distributions. That's a whole story in itself, but you can't do it until you're 70 and a half years of age. All right?
Okay.
All right,
thanks,
my friend.
Thanks so much, Drew.
Well, congratulations. You take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
We're going to Fred in Essex. Fred, how can we help you?
Well, my wife and I, in 1961, bought a waterfront property at the end of Back River.
Okay.
And for $15,000.
Okay.
And a year and a half ago, we moved 4 miles up the Back River Neck Road, rented a house on the premise that we would build a new house on this waterfront lot.
Okay.
But in the meantime, her cancer come back after 10 years. So that postponed, house builder search. And then I had two hips replaced last year after she got her cancer under control.
Ah, okay.
And then in February, we bought a house across the road from the waterfront, one address above.
Okay.
Above the waterfront. And we anticipate selling, but my hip surgery, my right last hip surgery didn't go correctly.
Okay.
So I'm in pursuit of getting that corrected.
Okay.
My concern is, what do we need to do within the timeline to avoid capital gains?
So have you sold the house, the waterfront property that you paid $15,000 for?
No, we haven't, but I haven't had it appraised yet, but based on property similar here that sold recently, and I would be offering it as a building lot, even though it's got a residence on it that was built in 1928.
So what's the value?
I don't know, but I would say based on... adjacent properties, it'd be in $300,000 or so.
Okay. Well, unless you lived in a house on that property, right?
We lived there for 56 years.
And that house is still there, right?
Yeah, unoccupied.
Unoccupied. And how long ago did you move out to the rental property?
It was in October of year 16.
Year 16. So you have until October of 2019 to sell that house and the lot, and you would, if you sell it for under $400,000, under $500,000, it'll be 100% tax-free because that's your principal residence two of the last 5 years.
Now, you might be able to advise me on this. The house we rented, the rent began in July.
Okay.
Of year 16.
Okay.
But we didn't actually move out of the waterfront residence until October.
Yeah, but you see, all that matters, Fred, is that did you file your tax return using the new rental properties the next year starting 17? Did you vote in the same place? You know, it's going to be, you know, it's you've got until October of 2019 at the minimum to sell that house.
And it's in the same voting district.
Yeah. So you've got a minimum until October of 2019. I could even argue that if I just have you move back into that house for a little while, you know, I could argue that we could continue to have it even beyond that. But I would just sell it. If you're not looking to live there now or not looking to build there now, I would just sell it, and it's going to be tax-free as long as you sell it for less than $500,000.
And I have five people already.
Well, then go ahead and sell it, and as long as you sell it for less than $500,000, my friend, you are completely tax-free.
Okay,
all right?
Now, could you give me your office number? Should I have?
I'll put you on hold, and he'll give that to you, and you can call us if you have any other questions. Okay.
Okay, Drew. And what's the name of your company or organization?
Financial Consulate. Just ask for Drew. He'll give you the number. 410-823-7283. Hold on there, Fred. All right, well, I'm going to go to traffic, and we'll be back with our other callers in a second. No, that's an easy one. Steely Dan. I'm going. I'm going to Charles.
That sounds like the 60s. Not
Steely
Dan.
Steely Dan. Yeah, I'm serious. Charles in Nottingham. He knew the answer to that.
Nottingham is speaking. How are you doing there, sir?
I'm doing well, sir. And you?
All right, you know what? Listen, I'm about confused.
Okay.
You know, I have roughly about 7.5 years ago before I retired.
Okay.
And I do have a nice pie chart set up for retirement. But recently, Dad, my father, which is in San Antonio, Texas, he threw in the pie chart two homes and a lot.
Okay.
And everything is okay. Everything is put deeded over to myself. Now, I got people wanting to buy these things, but I don't know what the capital gains. I'm just.
When did your father pass away, Charles?
You know what? He didn't pass away. The guy just, you know, he retired. He put himself in a senior citizen development. He said he's through with all of it. It's mine.
So he gave it to you during his lifetime.
That's right.
So when somebody gives property to you during their lifetime, the cost basis in the hands of the giver is your cost basis in the hands of the receiver. So if Dad paid $50,000 for one of the houses, and that's his cost basis, and it's now worth $200,000, then you have a $150,000 gain. So what you need to do is go back to Dad or Dad's accountant and say, what's Dad's cost basis in this house? What's Dad's cost basis in that house that he gifted to me over the last year or two so I can figure out what my capital gain exposure is?
Good.
Did he rent those houses by any chance, Charles?
Yes, he did.
Okay, so now that makes it even more interesting and complicated because let's say I buy a house for $200,000 and my cost basis is $200,000 and I rent that house for 20 years and now the house is worth $250,000. It really didn't appreciate much and it's worth $250,000. You would think that you only have a gain of about $50,000. But you probably will have a gain of almost $200,000 because depreciation is something that's taken every year on a tax return. And when you, of a rental property, and when you go to sell it, you have to factor into the cost basis every year of depreciation that was ever taken and recapture it at the time of the sale. And so over 20 years, it would be theoretically logical that he would have taken close to two-thirds, almost three-quarters of the value of that house as depreciation, and therefore you probably would only have about $50,000 of cost basis left, and therefore you'd have to recapture the $150,000 plus the $50,000 of gain that took place. But the accountant who did the tax return should have that right there on the tax return ready for you at any moment you ask them.
Well, my thought was to take this money here, whatever it is, and put it into an IRA fund or something. What I'm trying to do is prep it up for 7.5 years to go.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's another theory, too. The other theory is that if they're good rental properties and they do rent well and they have long-term tenants in them, you could find a management company down there in San Antonio. I'm assuming that's where they're at, right?
That's right. That's right.
You could find a management company down there in San Antonio to maintain the properties for you. And the income you would get out of those rental properties could be quite substantial for you compared to what you would have after you pay all the sales taxes and the transfer taxes, I mean, and the commissions to the real estate agents and then the capital gains to the United States government. And you're going to have to pay capital gains to both New Mexico, possibly, and then Maryland is going to consider whether they want a little piece of the action also.
That makes all the sense in the world. You answered my question.
So that's maybe what I would do, is look at the possibility of keeping them as rental properties. And San Antonio is a very popular area right now. And so, you know, it's a tax-free state. Well, actually, I said New Mexico. He said San Antonio. I was thinking of Santa Fe, New Mexico.
No, he said
San Antonio. That's Texas.
Sure.
And Texas is a tax-free state. So we don't have to worry about Texas. But Maryland would want about 8 or 9% of the sale of those properties because you're a Maryland resident. Just because you sell it in a tax-free state is not going to mean that Maryland is not going to want 9% of the profit. So I would probably just continue to rent it, and maybe someday you retire, and when you retire, you go live in San Antonio yourself, and you got a couple homes to choose from to live in.
Thank you.
All right, buddy.
You answered my question. I'll just leave that in the pie, the chart itself, and consider it, you know, income towards retirement.
They're good homes, right? And got good tenants in them.
Oh, yeah. They've had long-term tenants in them. I know them very well.
If I were you, I would keep those going and make those tenants happy, and the least, amount of worry you have for them. And if it doesn't work, you can sell them in the future. If they become a pain in the neck, you can sell them in the future. All right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. You've answered my question. Thank you very much, sir.
But keep in mind one more thing, Charles. You do have to go to the accountant who was doing the tax returns before, because you're going to need that information to do your own tax returns now that you own those properties. Okay?
Yes, sir.
All right, Charles. Have a good night.
Thank you very much for your
answer. All right. Take care. That was an interesting question.
Yeah,
did
sure.
Did you find it as interesting as I did?
Sure. Yeah, I'm with you. I am there.
Were you even listening?
I am there.
You were there. We only have a couple minutes left. What's happening next week? We have a guest coming on?
We do have a guest next week, Sherry Dorsey.
Oh, we're talking estate planning with Sherry Dorsey.
We are.
Yeah, that should be a pretty good topic in the show.
Yeah.
So, in the last minute or two, you know, we've got 2 minutes to go. Do you have something you wanted to talk about, Chris, before I launch in there?
No, go ahead. If you have something, go for it.
Well, I was just going back to that economic bias thing, you know, I'll tell you, this is one of the situations that most people, most of our listeners, this is a valuable piece of information. is that your property casualty insurance agent, the one that does your auto and home insurance, in my opinion, has an economic bias that you don't realize, and you don't realize that their economic bias is probably underinsuring you. And what do I mean by that? I mean that, number one, the average person who has any kind of net worth and has any kind of income, let's say income over $100,000 and a net worth of $500,000 or more, should have uninsured motorist coverage of at least $500,000 per person, $1 million per accident. And I bet you that the average person listening right now carries bodily injury, the liability they'll pay to somebody else, an uninsured motorist, of no more than $100,000 per person, $300,000 per accident. And there's an economic bias of property casualty agents to do that. I hate to say it, but it's true. In addition, the average person listening to this radio show probably is insured with State Farm or Nationwide or Allstate. Those are very popular companies to be insured with, and I tend to find them to be some of the absolute worst companies to be insured with from an overall coverage perspective that the agents tend to give those clients, and the cost of the policy. The number one companies, in my opinion, would be companies like Erie Insurance. Erie is hard to beat, you know. If you're outside the Beltway, you got to be outside the Beltway. Inside the Beltway, all bets are off as to who you're going to be going with. But there are a lot of other companies, State Auto Mutual, Donegal, Brethren Mutual, occasionally I see them to be very competitive. Compass can be very competitive inside the city, as it can be a very good company. I'm not a big fan of Geico. I know a lot of people are. I'm not a fan of Geico at all. But anyway, economic bias.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about.
That's right.
And if you have auto and home insurance, you should be really seriously rethinking what's going on, and are you getting your coverage at the best price you can and the right coverage. Anyway, we got to go, Chris. This is Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.